I want you to imagine a scenario for a second. Think about where you live right now. Think about your neighbors.
Okay.
Now, imagine that the person your community actually hired to, maintain the grounds, fix the common areas, just basically keep the entire place running
All
smoothly.
right, the caretaker.
Exactly. Imagine that person is also your next door neighbor. Like they own a unit right down the hall from you.
Which, I mean, that already sounds like a recipe for a very specific, very potent kind of awkwardness if things start to go wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
Because mixing your home life with your employment right in the exact same building, that is just walking a tightrope.
It really is. You can't just, clock out and go home at the end of the day because you are already home.
Yeah, you're always on the clock, sort of.
Right. So now I want you to imagine you go down and open your mailbox one morning. You pull out this very official-looking letter from the community board. And this letter has been blasted out to the entire neighborhood, essentially just calling out this neighbor caretaker for doing a terrible job.
Oh, wow. See, that is not just a little neighborhood drama anymore.
No, it really isn't.
That is a massive collision of personal, professional, and legal boundaries. I mean, it is basically public humiliation mixed with a performance review, and it's delivered to literally everyone you share a fence with.
It is the absolute definition of a mess. And, while it sounds like the plot of some suburban soap opera, this exact scenario actually spiraled into a highly complex, fiercely fought legal battle.
It really did.
It became this profound dispute over the very definition of power over bureaucratic procedure, and really what happens when people weaponize the rule book just to avoid having an actual human confrontation.
And that is exactly what we are looking at today. We are going to examine how a localized, seemingly petty squabble just transforms into a fascinating case study on human governance.
Yes. So, welcome to today's deep dive. Our source material for this exploration is an official, highly detailed legal document.
A very detailed one.
Extremely. Specifically, it is a March 20, 2026 adjudicator's order from the Office of the Commissioner for Body Corporate and Community Management in Queensland, Australia.
That is a mouthful.
It is, yeah. The citation is 2026 QBCC MCMR 87, and it is centered around a community called the Village Chancellor Park.
It is a remarkable document, honestly, because while on the surface, adjudicators' orders can seem incredibly dry.
Well, for sure. Lots of jargon.
Yeah, they are full of statutory references and procedural jargon. But if you look closely, they are essentially the written records of human dysfunction.
That is a great way to put it.
They show us exactly how systems handle us when we just cannot handle each other.
Right. So the mission of this deep dive is to dissect this hyperlocal dispute at the Village Chancellor Park. We want to extract the brilliant universal insights buried in this ruling about bureaucracy, the absolute limits of committee power, and what happens when you try to use technicalities to win a personality clash.
I love that.
Okay, let's unpack this, because we have to start by establishing exactly who the players are and the exact nature of the conflict that kicked this whole thing off.
Right, because without the context of these interpersonal relationships, the legal arguments just look like a lot of, well, a lot of paper shuffling.
Exactly.
The human context is everything here.
So we have two key individuals, Tony Thompson and Kwee Wae Hee. They are the applicants in this legal dispute, and they are the owners of Lot 14 at the Village Chancellor Park.
Okay.
So they are residents, just like anyone else in the community,
Yeah.
but crucially, they wear a second, very heavy hat. They are also the representatives of an entity called Thompson and Hee Group PDLTD.
And that entity happens to be the caretaking service contractor and letting agent for the entire body corporate.
Right.
So they live there, they are neighbors, but they are also legally contracted and paid to take care of the place. They are deeply structurally embedded in the community matrix.
It's so tangled, and the tension finally snaps in late July 2025. This is the inciting incident.
To breaking point.
Yeah. The body corporate committee decides they cannot just keep whispering in the hallways or having informal chats anymore.
Ah.
On July 25th, they send a letter on official letterhead to all the owners in the scheme.
Wow.
And this letter is not a friendly neighborhood update about, like, an upcoming barbecue. It expresses, quote, serious concerns about the caretaker's performance.
And the applicants, Tony and Kliwe, they describe the contents of this letter as containing untested allegations about their performance and their motives.
Which is a strong phrase, untested allegations.
It really is. We are talking about severe critiques of how they do their job, And furthermore, the letter explicitly invites all the other owners to contact the committee directly with their own feedback or complaints about the caretakers.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it is basically an open call for grievances.
You can just imagine the temperature in the neighborhood immediately boiling over.
Mm.
I mean, you are the caretaker, and suddenly all 50 of your neighbors have a letter in hand asking for a list of everything you have ever done wrong.
It's a nightmare scenario.
But Thompson and he... they don't just write a letter back saying, hey, we are doing a great job. Here is a list of all the lawns we mowed.
Right. They don't engage on the facts.
No, they launch a massive,
yeah,
highly technical counterattack.
Yes, they bypass the substance of the critique entirely and go straight for the procedural jugular.
Straight for it.
They don't defend their caretaking at all. They claim that this July 25th letter was never actually authorized by a valid, formal committee resolution.
They're basically saying, you sent this on official letterhead, you made it look like an official body corporate decision, but you never actually sat down and took a formal, legally binding vote to send it.
Exactly. They argued this caused massive confusion among the lot owners who, you know, started contacting the caretakers to ask if they were officially in trouble.
Which makes sense.
Right. And they also claim this rogue action breached a specific rule called Schedule 1A, the Code of Conduct for Voting Committee Members.
Okay, what does that code say?
Well, this code requires committee members to act honestly, fairly, and in the body corporate's best interests.
So instead of arguing about the actual maintenance work, they drag the committee to the commissioner's office.
Yeah.
They officially file an application to strike the letter from the record, demanding what they call a corrective notice.
Right.
They want the body corporate forced to send another letter to everyone, admitting that the first letter was unauthorized, invalid, and essentially just a rogue communication.
It is a fascinating, evasive strategy. I mean, they are completely sidestepping the actual critique of their work and focusing entirely on the procedural mechanism of how that critique was delivered.
It makes me think of a corporate environment. It's like, imagine a middle manager getting frustrated and sending a company-wide email roasting a specific third-party vendor for terrible service.
Oh, I can picture that.
But here's a catch.
Yeah.
That vendor also happens to be a major shareholder in the company, and the manager never actually got official board approval to hit send on that company-wide blast.
Right.
The vendor isn't going to argue about the quality of the paper they supply or whatever.
Mm.
They are going to demand the manager be fired for unauthorized use of the company email server.
That is a perfect analogy. It takes a dispute about quality and instantly transforms it into a dispute about jurisdiction and authority.
Exactly.
And the moment they file that application with the commissioner, the story completely transitions from the drama of a nasty gram into the cold, hard mechanics of the justice system.
And this is where the story hits a bureaucratic wall that I just found absolutely mind-boggling. Because we transition into how the legal process actually works day to day.
Yes. So the body corporate committee submits their legal defense to the adjudicator, essentially explaining their side of the story and defending the letter they sent.
Makes sense.
Now, standard legal procedure dictates that the applicants, the caretakers, are then given the opportunity to read that defense and submit a reply.
Which is pretty standard, right?
Right. It is a fundamental part of the legal process. You get to see what the other side is saying about you so you can properly defend yourself.
But imagine you get a notice from a tribunal saying your opponents have submitted their arguments. But to actually see those documents, you run into a highly specific, very literal paywall.
A literal paywall, yeah.
The adjudicator's office informs the caretakers that according to Section 246 of the Act, if they want copies of the committee's submissions, they have to pay a legally prescribed fee.
And the total comes to exactly $116.20.
Which is just such a specific number.
It is. And we really need to understand why that fee exists. It is calculated on a strict per-page basis set by state regulation.
Okay, so it's not just made up.
No, it is not an arbitrary number the adjudicator just made up to be difficult. The government mechanism here is designed to prevent frivolous administrative burdens.
Right.
A taxpayer-funded adjudicator's office simply cannot act as a free, unlimited copying and mailing service for every single neighborhood dispute in Queensland.
That makes sense when you put it that way.
The fee covers the literal administrative cost of reproducing and processing all those documents. Alternatively, the office tells them they can come down in person and inspect the documents.
Oh, okay. So there's a free option.
Well, no. Even that isn't free.
Wait, really?
Yeah. That requires staff supervision, so it costs $20.70 an hour, up to a maximum of $81.30 a day.
Oh, wow. So the caretakers, they wait. They drag this out for 2 full weeks, right up until March 2, 2026. Then they finally reply to the adjudicator's office, claiming they simply cannot afford the $116 fee.
Right.
And they essentially ask, hey, can we just submit a bunch of new arguments anyway without even reading their defense?
To which the office replies on the exact same day.
They were quick with that one.
Very quick. The bureaucracy is very clear. No, you cannot raise entirely new issues in a reply phase. The reply is strictly for addressing the defense.
Obviously.
They reiterate that the fee is mandatory under the act, and they ask the caretakers to decide as soon as possible if they want to pay the fee or come in to inspect the document.
And then absolute crickets.
Nothing.
The caretakers go completely silent. They just abandon the reply process entirely.
What is fascinating here is how the adjudicator handles this silence. It goes right to the heart of how legal systems balance fairness with efficiency.
How so?
The adjudicator references Section 269 of the Act. This section requires the adjudicator to observe a principle called natural justice.
Natural justice. That sounds so grand and, like, philosophical.
It does sound lofty. In this context, it basically means giving all parties a fair and reasonable opportunity to put their case forward.
Right.
You can't just judge someone in secret without letting them speak or see the evidence against them.
Right.
But, and this is the crucial practical part of Section 269, it also demands that the adjudicator decide matters as quickly as is consistent with a proper consideration of the application.
So they can't just wait forever.
Exactly. The system cannot be allowed to stall indefinitely just because one party decides to take their ball and go home.
Okay, I have to jump in here and push back on this concept because it just feels wild to me. Wait, so natural justice costs $116.20.
I know how it sounds.
Like, if you don't pay the copy fee, you just lose your right to counter-argue. How does the adjudicator justify just moving on? They literally say they are doing it to, quote, allow all parties to move on. Isn't justice supposed to be blind to wealth?
It is a really valid critique, and honestly, it is a tension point in almost every legal system in the world. Access to justice is a huge issue.
Yeah.
But from the adjudicator's perspective, natural justice isn't about guaranteeing you get the documents handed to you for free. It is about guaranteeing you are given the opportunity to access them according to the exact same rules everyone else plays by.
I see. So the rules apply to everyone equally.
Right. The adjudicator ruled that by offering the copies at the legally prescribed regulatory rate and offering the cheaper in-person inspection option, the opportunity was properly provided.
Okay, fair enough.
The caretakers chose not to take it, and they chose to stop communicating. The adjudicator simply cannot let the entire governance of the Village Chancellor Park freeze in time because one party won't pay the filing fee and refuses to answer emails.
It is the ultimate administrative roadblock.
Yeah.
The bureaucracy basically says, we gave you the menu, you didn't like the prices, so we are moving to the next table.
Precisely. And because the caretakers abandon their reply, the adjudicator is forced to look at the core issue based only on the initial filings.
Right.
Adjudicator D. Sutherland has to decide the main event. Did the committee actually break the law by sending that July 25th letter without a formal recorded vote?
But wait, let me play devil's advocate for the caretakers for a second here.
Go for it.
If the committee is sending an official letter, on official letterhead, to all of my neighbors saying I am objectively bad at my job, don't I have a right to demand they follow official voting procedures?
It feels like you should.
Right. Isn't that what the rules are for? If my reputation is on the line, shouldn't they have to take a formal vote to attack it?
That is exactly the argument the caretakers were relying on. And you're right, it makes intuitive sense. But the adjudicator dismisses the application entirely, and the reasoning dismantles that exact assumption.
Oh, wow.
It reveals a massive fundamental distinction in how governance and really how power works.
Right. Adjudicator Sutherland outlines a very clear legal boundary here.
Exactly. The adjudicator states that a body corporate, the committee, only needs a formal resolution if it is doing something that actually affects the rights, interests, or obligations of parties.
Okay, so it has to have a tangible impact.
Yes. A formal resolution is a legal source of power.
So if the committee is raising a levy, meaning they are legally making everyone pay more money, they need a vote.
Yes.
If they are spending community funds to, I don't know, pave the driveway, they need a vote.
Correct.
Or, crucially, if they are issuing a formal remedial action notice, which is a legally binding warning that could directly lead to the caretaker's contract being terminated, they would absolutely need a formal vote.
Spot on. But the July 25th letter was none of those things.
Interesting.
The adjudicator defines the letter merely as an expression of a consensus of the committee's view.
A consensus of their view. Okay.
It was a shared observation coupled with an invitation for feedback. It didn't formally commit the body corporate to taking any legal action against the caretakers. It didn't alter anyone's contractual rights. It didn't dock their pay.
And the adjudicator goes even further, right? Explaining the underlying mechanism of why the committee is actually supposed to do this.
Yes, this is a great point.
They note that a body corporate actually has a fiduciary duty to express its views to the members about the quality of the services their money is paying for.
Right. Think about the mechanism of a fiduciary duty. The committee members are elected to protect the financial interests of the owners.
Exactly.
If the committee genuinely believes the caretaker is doing a bad job, like leaving the lawns overgrown or the pool dirty, and they don't tell the owners, they are actually failing in their duty to the people footing the bill.
Wow, I didn't think about it that way. Yeah, they are legally obligated to communicate their concerns. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it highlights the fundamental difference between holding an opinion and executing a legal power.
Right.
Having an opinion and communicating that opinion to stakeholders is a right and sometimes a fiduciary duty. Executing a power that forcefully changes someone's legal or financial standing is an action, and that requires strict procedural authorization.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I was trying to map this legal philosophy onto everyday life.
Oh, I'd love to hear this.
Think about your own family sitting around the dinner table. You all look out the window and agree, you know what, the roof over the garage looks really leaky, it's a mess, we need to do something.
Okay, yeah.
That is an expression of a shared view. Compare that to the same family actually signing a legally binding $10,000 contract with a roofing company to replace it.
Huge difference.
Discussing the leaky roof is an opinion. It's an observation. You don't need a formal family vote complete with a quorum and meeting minutes just to complain to each other about the roof. Right.
But you absolutely need consensus and authorization to spend the actual money to fix it.
And the caretakers were essentially trying to take the family to court for complaining about the roof without taking a formal vote first.
Yes.
That's exactly it.
They deliberately confuse the expression of dissatisfaction with a legally binding penalty.
But the committee, perhaps realizing they were in hot water or maybe just trying to cover their bases after the fact, they did actually try to fix this later on.
They did. Even though the adjudicator ultimately ruled a vote wasn't strictly required to just send a letter, the committee had held a meeting on August 5, 2025, and officially ratified the sending of the letter anyway.
Nah.
They basically took a retroactive vote to say, for the official record, yes, we all agreed to send that.
And of course, the caretakers wouldn't let that go either. They pointed to something called the accommodation module. And just to clarify for everyone listening, the accommodation module is basically the specific set of state regulations governing how these community schemes operate, particularly concerning voting procedures and how things get approved.
Right. And the caretakers argued that under the specific module, you cannot retrospectively validate an act through informal discussion.
So they're attacking the fix.
Exactly. They argued the retroactive vote was flawed, meaning the letter remained permanently unauthorized and illegal.
And this is where the adjudicator finally seems to just like run out of patience with the endless paper shuffling. Adjudicator Sutherland completely swats this argument away.
Just dismisses it.
The ruling states that any procedural defect in that retroactive vote was, quote, trivial in the circumstances.
Trivial.
The adjudicator explicitly notes that they are legally entitled to simply disregard a trivial procedural defect if it doesn't change the material reality of the situation.
It is the legal equivalent of a judge rolling their eyes, which perfectly sets up the climax of this entire document. Paragraph 17 of the ruling.
Yes, paragraph 17.
This is where the adjudicator drops the hammer and connects all this lofty legal theory back to the messy human reality of the Village Chancellor Park.
Paragraph 17 is a masterclass in judicial real talk.
It really is.
Adjudicator writes, the applicants seem overly concerned with trivial instances of committee noncompliance. Plainly, the root of the problem lies in their deteriorating relationship with the committee as caretakers.
Boom. The adjudicator just calls it out into the open. It's not about Schedule 1A. It's not about the technicalities of the accommodation module.
Yeah.
It is about the fact that you guys fundamentally hate working together and your relationship has completely broken down.
The document even casually mentions, almost as an aside, that these exact same parties have another entirely separate complex dispute already pending.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. It's cited as 2026 QBCCM CMR 33, and it actually falls outside of this specific adjudicator's jurisdiction because it's just so convoluted. The well is completely, totally poisoned between these two groups.
And as a final reality check, the adjudicator points out the ultimate irony of what the caretakers were demanding. Remember, the caretakers wanted an order forcing the committee to send a new letter to all owners saying, "We dispute the first letter."
Right. They wanted everyone to know they were fighting it.
But the adjudicator notes that by filing this very legal application in the first place, the dispute materials were automatically mailed to all the owners as a matter of public record anyway.
Wait, really? So everyone already got the rebuttal in the mail?
Exactly. The adjudicator basically says, "You have already achieved your goal. The owners already know you are fighting the committee because you sued them."
Oh, that is hilarious.
I am not going to issue a redundant order to tell them what they already know just to satisfy your need for a procedural victory.
That is amazing.
This raises an important question, doesn't it, about how we use and abuse the rules.
Definitely.
The caretakers tried to use a tiny procedural loophole, a missing formal vote on a letter, to completely squash a very real substantive critique of their actual job performance.
They weaponized procedure.
They absolutely did. They tried to make the conversation exclusively about how the message was delivered so they wouldn't have to answer for what the message actually said about their work.
Which is such a common tactic.
It is an incredibly common defensive tactic. We see it not just in law, but in corporate environments, in politics, in HOAs, everywhere. If you know you can't win an argument on the actual facts, you attack the process.
So what does this all mean? When you strip away the legal citations, the accommodation module, and the prescribed filing fees, it is like watching a couple in a kitchen arguing fiercely.
Oh, I like this analogy.
They are screaming at each other over the exact proper angle to load a plate into the dishwasher. But anyone watching knows they aren't actually mad about the dishwasher.
No, never.
They are arguing about the plates because they simply resent each other. And it is so much easier to fight about the rigid rules of loading dishes than it is to look at each other and say, "I am deeply unhappy in this relationship."
Right.
And in this case, Adjudicator Sutherland looked at them and flat out refused to play couples therapist over a dishwasher.
The adjudicator forced them to look at the real issue rather than letting them hide behind the safety and really the distraction of the rule book.
We have covered a massive amount of ground today. We started with the petty neighborhood nasty gram. We crashed into a $116 roadblock at the gates of natural justice. We explored the profound legal difference between holding an opinion versus taking formal action.
A lot of ground.
And we ended with an adjudicator telling a squabbling community to stop hiding behind trivial procedural complaints and face their actual toxic relationship issues.
It is a brilliant reminder that the law is designed to manage our interactions and set boundaries, but it cannot cure our dysfunctions.
No, it can't.
It can only point out where the real problem lies.
Which leaves you with a final thought to mull over. If legal tribunals and adjudicators can easily see right through us when we weaponize the rules to avoid facing our real interpersonal conflicts, what does it cost us?
Yeah.
Financially, emotionally, and communally, what is the true cost when you insist on fighting a brutal, exhausting procedural war instead of just sitting down and having the hard human conversation?
That is the real deep dive right there.
Thanks for joining us. Keep asking the big questions.